This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Oh, hello, friends. It's your boy, Michael Cruz Kane. Remember me? Well, I'm back, and I brought with me a brand new episode of A Good Cry. Thanks for listening. I regret to inform you that since last week, when I advocated strongly for continuing to wear the mask, et cetera, if you were worried about getting COVID, your boy got COVID. Boom, boom. It sucks. I wish it had not happened. I did this comedy showcase where I had my mask off just while I was on stage, pretty much, and boom, got it. I've been with the headaches. I've been with the fever. I've been with the fatigue. I've been with the coughing. I've been with the sore throat. You can hear it a little bit in the voice. Hasn't been that bad, I think, because I'm vaccinated and boosted, but it's not been fun. My daughter has it. We spent all day trying not to let my son and wife also get it. It sucks. So if you are trying not to get COVID, keep trying not to get it. If you are vigilant, I believe you will succeed. I took my mask off. How bad could it be? Boom, got it right away. I'd gone so long without getting it. Shoot. Dang it. Okay. Grief thoughts. I'm going to segue pretty quickly into this episode, which is with my friend, the luminescent Rebecca Sofer, who is one of the co-founders of Modern Loss. She's also got the Modern Loss Handbook coming out, which I cannot recommend enough to you. We'll put the link to it in the description to this episode. It's not available yet, but you might as well pre-order it. It's a paradigm shifter on how you can work yourself, or someone you know can work themselves through grief. It's not something like, you know, fixes everything immediately, but it is something that helps you process grief in its fullness, which I think is something so many people neglect to do because it's painful or it's foreign, and all those things, and both of those things are scary. Rebecca and I have known each other for a few years. We've done events together that were grief-centric and also fun. And I hope that if you can't imagine how those two things can be combined, that you look her up and just follow everything she does. And we talk about the losses that she's had in her life and how those losses changed the direction of her life as well and what she wanted to do with that life. I love talking to her. I'll talk to her more, I'm sure. This is Rebecca Sofer on A Good Cry. Hi, Rebecca. How are you doing today?
I'm okay. I'm as I said, I'm full of breakfast tacos. So who can complain when one is full of breakfast tacos in Austin, Texas?
That's the way to be.
It is a nice state in which to be, like the state of being in breakfast tacos.
Oh, you don't mean the state of Texas?
No, I love Austin. I'm very happy to be here. I'm here in my hotel room for a couple of days, and I'm eating my way through the city, and you know, which is a tall order because the food is really good here. Yeah, and I'm gonna counterbalance it by having some good cries, good grief talk.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, perfect segue. Our first question, Rebecca, tell us about your relationship with the grief. How would you describe it?
I would describe it as a very close one. We are intimately acquainted, grief and me. I mean, I knew what the feeling of grief was-ish, you know, when I was younger and my grandfather died, and then my other grandfather died. And in fact, when I was a teenager, I had a good friend in Israel who was killed in a plane crash. And so I feel like I had, you know, these experiences with loss. I would say the first two were, I was very young when my first grandfather died. And then I was about 10 or 11 when my other grandpa died. And it was very sad, I would say, but it wasn't like, foundationally altering. He'd been very ill for like most of my life. But when I was 30 and I was living in New York and I was kind of very much in the build phase of my life, because in New York, you know, you just like when you're 30, that's when you're, you know, still living with the Jennifer convertible and whatever furniture crap you brought from undergrad, and it's all in your apartment. Cause like 30 in New York is like 18 everywhere else. And I had just graduated from journalism school and I was working at the Colbert Report, and I really felt like I was like starting my life already. And then my mom was killed in a car accident. So I had been working at this show for about a year, and I thought that, you know, everything was very much in build mode, and I was really excited to kind of figure out my crap and, you know, get a promotion and get an apartment and get a partner and a dog and everything. And then my mom died. And so from one second to the next, I became very intimately acquainted with grief, and that is something that will never go away. That is a forever thing. And then my dad, 4 years after my mom died, my dad died. So I was 34. I was living in the same exact apartment in New York, although mercifully with some upgraded furniture. I'd gotten rid of the Jennifer convertible by then.
Congrats.
Thank you. It was a milestone moment in my maturation. But my new husband, my relatively new husband, came home in the middle of the morning and said, "I have news." And he was totally gray. And he told me that my dad had been traveling abroad and that he had a heart attack very early that morning and didn't survive. And so between the ages of 30 and 34, I went from having two very much alive, caring, cheerleading, hilarious, encouraging, amazing parents who were my people to not having either one of them. And that was a real surprise to me. That was not my life plan.
In your retelling of that, your husband knew about your dad dying before you knew, is that right?
Yeah. So, well, I was single when my mom died. I, again, like the Jennifer convertible, the terrible furniture situation, I was just kind of like living my romper room lifestyle, you know, working in TV, you know. And when she died, I was single. When my dad died, I had been married for, oh gosh, maybe like a year or so. I think it was my uncle called my husband, because everybody knew that I found out about my mom through a phone call. And the night my mom died, I slept with my phone next to my head every single night for 4 years, because I was kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop in my life. I was just so incredibly aware of the fact that we aren't guaranteed any sort of number of days, that I just would sleep with my phone. And so I think that there was this kind of care that went into delivering the message so that I wouldn't pick up the phone and learn yet again from the same apartment that my other parent had died. So I think it was kind of an act of kindness, yeah.
That's very sweet. I mean, that's very thoughtful.
But it still sucked, by the way.
Yeah. Still terrible. Yeah, well, I mean, to hear you put it that way, like waiting for the other shoe to drop, I feel like so often people use that phrase, the end result is, and then the other shoe never dropped. I just left. I lived in this, you know, sense of anxiety that was totally unfounded.
Oh, no.
But the other shoe in your story drops, it drops big time.
Do you say it was found? It was very much founded? But it was very much,
yes,
warranted. That sense of anxiety was
quite
definitely,
founded.
It was quite founded. You know, the interesting thing is that my parents were actually 20 years apart from each other in age. So my dad was 20 years older than my mom. And we always used to say like, oh, you know, when dad died, we would literally talk about it, like just very, in very casual conversation, like when dad dies. And by the way, I didn't want my father to die. It's just that we just kind of assumed,
right,
that the natural order of things would occur. My parents, I remember they downsized their house and they moved to a condo. I'm from Philadelphia and they moved to like this condo outside Philly from my big, big, you know, house that I grew up in. And I remember me telling my mom, oh God, like, thank God we did this now, because after dad dies, like, oh my God, it would be so hard and whatever. And the joke was on all of us that, in fact, no, my dad was going to outlive my mom because she was going to die in a car accident. And so I think I just kind of, it just hit me like, oh, I have no idea what, nothing makes sense anymore. Like literally, I don't know. I felt very untethered from everything I had known when that happened. And so, yeah, I slept with that phone next to my head because I was insanely paranoid about getting another phone call. And it did happen, you know, and it was terrible. It wasn't my plan to be, you know, I guess like you say orphan and you think about like Oliver, like asking for more gruel and, you know, I always did, right? Or like, you know, the daytime ads for the charities, you know, around the world that you see at like 2 p.m. when you're at home. But I felt, I really did feel like Oliver holding that like dented pail, asking for more gruel. Like I felt like a tiny little kid when my dad died and I realized that I didn't have living parents anymore, when I still felt like there was so much that I wanted to accomplish in life that I kind of assumed that they'd be around to witness and help me through and enjoy with me.
That brings up so many questions to me, like, okay, so first of all, going back to the shoe dropping, do those events in your life lead you to like a constant fear of shoe dropping? Are you always, or is it like the things that could have happened have happened? Is it more like that kind of feeling?
Well, I will say that I remember the day my dad died. I remember that night. I left my BlackBerry, let's be honest. It was BlackBerry era. I'm a late technology adopter. I definitely was like the last person to get an iPhone. I was like tapping it out on the BlackBerry and I left it in my living room. And I said to my husband, well, there's no one left to learn about. It's, you know, so I'm just going to go to sleep. I mean, I don't need my phone anymore. And that's very much not true because I have an enormous number of friends who I love so much all around the world, actually, and family I love. And now I have two kids who I love who weren't in existence then. But at that moment, it really did feel like the other shoe had dropped. And that was kind of it. In that moment, the enormity of it, I would say like the realization that I had lost my two greatest witnesses to life, to my life up until that point, was really just like too much for me to wrap my head around. And so, yeah, I do feel like I am somebody who's always kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop right now. But I also feel like I've gotten really used to, out of sheer necessity for survival, for my mental sanity, for living with discomfort and living with uncertainty. And kind of like, I'm not happy living with uncertainty. And I do look around, you know, sometimes when I'm like having a great dinner with friends and I'm like in my mind, I'm like, you're going to die and you're going to die. And I don't know when you're going to die. I could drop dead today. Like I could get hit by a bus leaving dinner. And I do think like that, but I just don't externalize that a lot because that's very creepy. Like no one would hang out with me. But I feel like I've just, it accompanies me. It's like my companion, which is uncertainty and discomfort. And I think that anybody listening to this might actually identify with what I'm saying, because over the last 2 years, it's been proven to us time and again that nothing is certain and that we're actually all living with a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me. Tell me if this feels like you. The way that I am is that I don't live in like constant fear of tragedy. I don't really think about it. Except when I do, and then I think about it profoundly.
That's it. That's it. Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Oh, I can't. I actually, like, you know, I don't think about my son died. I don't think about my other children dying until, like, you know, they're headed to the airport without me. And then I'm like, the fucking plane's going to crash. Oh my God, it's going to crash. And I'm like texting my wife just to be like, hey, just make sure, like, what's she going to do? I don't know. She's going to go in there and pep talk the pilot or something.
I saw her. She has latent talents. I bet she probably secretly knows how to land a plane.
Yeah, she could fly a plane. But so I'm like fine, except for the, you know, 1% of the time where I'm like, oops, I've catastrophized this, which I don't think I did before my son died. You know what I mean? I think I had, I'm not sure if healthy, but like normal level of assuming that terrible shit could happen at any time. You know what I mean? The same, which was basically assuming that it wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, and frankly, not to be too audacious here, but like, you know, I think we kind of share an ethos. Like, I don't walk around all day long freaking out about everything ending on Earth. I think that if anything, my experiences with grief have really pushed me to really, like, it's a cliche for a reason, to carpe diem. Like, I know that, you know, living with the extreme awareness that I am not guaranteed any timeline whatsoever, it has really encouraged me to just like jump, like not always in like a very intelligent way, but like kind of like jump first and then figure it out. I mean, it's the whole reason Modern Loss exists. I didn't know who the hell would read it, but I'm like, I need something like this and maybe someone else does. But I think it's really encouraged me to take risks because I'm kind of like, well, what's the worst that can happen? It kills me. You know, it's probably not going to kill me or anybody else around me. So why not just take the risk? But then there is, like you said, that 1% of time where your brain just kind of goes on to overdrive. And I think it's in situations, like you said, where I'm not directly involved. Like you're like, your kids are going on a flight and you're not there. And you're like, oh God, I have literally no control. Like if something happens, I can't tighten their seatbelt or I can't tell them I love them one last time. I'm just completely impotent. And like, that's when it's going to happen. That's when the worst is going to happen again. And yeah, that totally happens to me. And it's super not fun.
Yes. Very, very, very not fun. You also talked about the, you know, one aspect of the grief of losing your parents, you describe it as losing your witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk more about the significance of that?
Yeah. I mean, well, I'm an only child between my mom and dad. And so I quite literally feel like I lost my witnesses. Like, I feel like I know that there are people out there who have just all these incredibly fond memories of even like kindergarten and elementary school and high school. And they remember every detail. And I'm not one of those people. And I don't know if it's that I had a very unmemorable childhood, but like it was a good childhood. It was a great childhood. But I don't specifically remember in March of 89. Like that's not like the way that my memory works. And I feel like when my mom died, you know, she really was my person. And she was also a witness to so many other people's lives. I mean, I had 3 ex-boyfriends show up at her funeral, you know, and they were not there for me. they were there for her. I felt like she was this incredible witness and this incredible encourager and cheerleader. And she also was the documentarian of the family. You know, she was the one who, like, on the back of the pictures in the photo books, like, inevitably, like, there is very detailed, it's like Beck and Dad, like 12:42 p.m. Museum of Natural History, like Thursday, February 2nd, you know, 1982.
Yeah.
And but like, I don't have that level of recall. And she did. And she could always laugh with me. Like, I just feel like I lost the person who could tell me how far I came since having like really awful, you know, judgment in fashion and choosing to get a active perm for many years when I was a tween and clear braces, which was a very big mistake.
Oh, I had clear braces too. I also had clear braces.
Were they just, why? Like, what's the point? We all know that they're there.
So bad.
They're so,
I don't know.
I got them so and bad. Then I got them like right before my bat mitzvah because I'm like, no one's going to know. They all like, like they all knew.
Yeah. I describe it as it looks like your teeth have teeth.
It does. Yes. I got an extra set of teeth. And so I felt like I really had lost, you know, the person who could like not just remember with me, but remind me and then also like reflect upon things together. And as I was going through life, like as I was changing jobs and developing my career and my family life, like just kind of, you know, remember together. I'm a big storyteller, you know, I'm a storyteller. I connect through sharing stories. I love, like, you know, my mom died at the very end of our family camping trip in Lake George, up in the Adirondacks. And we spent a week on a campsite with no electricity, no running water, just shooting the shit over a campfire every night. And I felt like I lost that. And I lost that witness, and it's just not to get too meta, but you get into your head when you lose that people like that. You get into your head when you're like, I can't remember certain things, and it's really upsetting. And especially when you feel like, when I had kids, I remember my son was a baby and he had this like really weird acid reflux thing. It was like exorcist level, like head spinning, like spitting up every 2 seconds. It was very insane and violent. And I brought him to the pediatrician and I was like at my wit's end. I hadn't slept in 2 months. And she was like, well, did you have this as a baby? And I just was like, I have no idea. I don't have anybody left to ask. I don't know. There's no one who can tell me anything. I don't have the memory. And then I remember her saying, well, can your mom just come up and help you for a couple of days? And let's just say that was 8 years ago. And I'm still embarrassed when I go back to the pediatrician for checkups because of my reaction that day to her.
Which was what? Was it sadness or anger?
It was anger. It was definitely along the lines of, well, I fucking would, but she's fucking dead. and it might have been those exact words. And so, Dr. Hilda Beidel, I'm so sorry.
She's just like, okay, cool, great. Well, anyway.
Yeah, she's like, so no. But yeah, like the witness thing is really hard. You know, it just really is. And it remains hard. There, I can't sugarcoat it. Like I feel like the responsibility is all on my shoulders to like pass down family memories and traditions. And when I tell my kids bedtime stories, I'm trying to, I regurgitate memories as an exercise for myself in not forgetting. Like I'll try and think of like a memory that I had as a kid, something I did with my parents or some silly anecdote, and I'll turn it into a bedtime story. And it's part because I'm really running out of bedtime story material. I have resorted to, like 2 weeks ago, I told the Back to the Future narrative. And then I told the Better Off Dead plot line, I think, last month, which went over really well. But I do this as an exercise for myself. I'm like, maybe if I retell these things, then it'll kind of like codify in my brain and I'm not going to forget it. Because I don't have those people to remind me and I don't have the siblings to say, remember when you did this? Or also, remember when mom and dad did this? Remember that family vacation? It's just kind of like all in my head.
I mean, yeah, that you used the word untethered before. And that, I mean, makes so much sense, especially like so much of human life is change and growth. But it's like change from what? Like, what was I? And losing that repository of all that knowledge, both of them, I mean, I can only imagine what that's like.
I mean, it's awful. I think we always can only imagine, you know, like, I can only imagine what it's like to lose a baby. And to that I say, yeah, it's terrible. Like it's all terrible. And like, I know there's something that is called the grief Olympics where we compare and contrast and we're like, oh, but that's like the natural order of things. Like they should have lost a parent. But like the truth is that everybody's dynamic with another person is totally different. And everybody has, you know, even within the same family, you have a different relationship with the person who died. And so I don't believe in anything that's like, oh, this is harder, this is easier just because of the nature of like who that person was in relation to you. You just never know.
Right. The like the arithmetic of it or whatever, that's much more sophisticated than that.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I think it is. And like, I think that for me, the challenge was my mom dying when I was 30, very suddenly, very traumatically and violently, when I was in a job which you very much understand because we worked for the same person, where I would have to go in and talk about comedy every day. And I was going home and scared to go to sleep at night because I was really scared of what I would see in my dreams. And so I was really like trying to figure out, like, I was like 30 and I was not this like 7-year-old who maybe had a structure in place of social workers and maybe relatives and people to catch them. And then I wasn't like 87 and surrounded by people who probably had an idea
right.
of what it was like to lose somebody close to you. I was just like 30 and going to work and going to romper room. And I was the guinea pig of my colleagues for the most part and my friends for the most part. And it was lonely. It was really lonely.
That seems to segue naturally into a lot of the work that you do, which does a lot toward helping people who feel that way feel less lonely. Can you talk about Modern Loss?
Yeah. So Modern Loss is something that I started with my friend Gabby Berkner about 8.5 years ago. At the end of 2013, I was literally 10 months pregnant. You know, I say that because that's what you are. You get your, that's the full thing. It's like, just, I feel like we deserve all of those months to say. And it really came out of this feeling that I was just saying of like being in this very interesting position of being very much in build mode in life, like, you know, trying to move up in your career and move up in your personal life and like get all the things and, you know, just acquire all the experiences and live as much as you possibly could, like build mode. And then suddenly you're in extreme loss mode at the same time. And so like, how do you walk that line? Which you have to, there's no choice. Like I still had to pay the rent. I still had to pay for healthcare because by the by, I didn't get healthcare in those days.
Just yay.
Not a thing. Yeah, it was fun. You know, like I needed to be a functional human being in New York. I needed to be a functional 30-year-old person. I just had to, but I didn't know how to do that. Like, I mean, look, in early grief, nobody knows how to be a functional human being. You shouldn't. It's a monster that takes control of you. It calls all the shots. But I'm talking about like I was staring down the rest of my life and thinking, how am I going to build up a life that's like worth living and like really enjoyable and like really still lets me laugh because I love laughing and I love humor and I love my friends and I love all this. I love like carpe dieming and I love traveling. But also, how do I do that while feeling like I kind of want to die? Like, how do I do that while knowing that like I'm never doing Mother's Day with my mom ever again? She's never, ever going to meet any kid that I have. She'll never be at my wedding. How am I going to do that? And so I realized that I was just in this very interesting, demographic of people who were kind of building up their lives, but they didn't have a lot of social supports to catch them. Because of the nature of like, people are like, oh, they're an adult. Like they'll be okay. They'll figure it out. But like, I wasn't okay. And it took me a really long time to figure out like who my team was, like who was the right therapist who could help me and like who were the right friends who I could talk to without making me feel like the record was coming to a screeching halt whenever I talked about dead mom and dead dad. And I got really tired of feeling like the conversation had to be like, you know, not to bring up Better Off Dead again, but the scene, and I think we've talked about this, where Ricky's mom is like, did you hear about Susan? And then she's like, cancer. And it's like, I didn't want to talk like that, you know, and I didn't need the record to come to a screeching halt when I talked about my mom. Like, I didn't need that all the time. I didn't need for people to pity me. I just needed to feel like I wasn't going insane, thinking that maybe it didn't happen and spending all this energy pretending that my mom didn't die and then my dad didn't die. It felt like it could feel so much more refreshing if I could just be honest about it and not make it feel like it had to be a conversation ender every time. And so Modern Loss really came out of that, which is like, it was an enormously selfish project, which we launched, I would say, several years after my mom died, and 2013. So several years after she died and a few years after my dad died, because I felt like what was really missing in the conversation about grief was something where you could just storytell and you could let it all hang out and you could talk about things like how you're super jealous of pregnant people because you had a miscarriage, but that's okay. It's normal. It's a human emotion. It's not wrong. Or that like you look around at Mother's Day and you're just like so incredibly envious of everybody and everybody seems to have like a very much alive and very amazing mom and you're like, you feel very much alone. And obviously I know that's not reality.
Yes.
But like when you're in it, it looks like everybody has what you don't have. And I get that that's not the case.
That's so relatable. That feeling of like,
you know,
well, I guess 100% of moms are still alive except for mine.
Yeah. Yes. I had deduced that, that specifically 100% of moms on earth were not only alive and well, but also hugely supportive of their children and like just always brought up baked chicken whenever necessary and were just there. And obviously that's not the case. And I also know that like people who have living parents, that doesn't necessarily mean that those are close and supportive relationships. I get it. But when you're in those like zygote days of grief, you feel so alone and so lost. And no matter what, it's a solitary experience. There's no one who can take away that solitary feeling. But if you feel like you're not allowed to talk about it, then it becomes really solitary. And I felt like I would read these like one-off essays in the back of the New York Times Magazine about like someone whose dad died and then he was in the grocery store and he saw an ingredient and all of a sudden it was the connection of like memory and scent and, you know, food. And I was like, that's what drew me in. It wasn't like conversations that were clinical or hushed or in religious circles. I just wanted to share stories, not just about memories, but about like how I'm doing. Like, how am I doing a year after my mom died? Like, why is dating such a freaking disaster whenever you say your mom died? You know, why are your dates always shut down? I just wanted to talk about like what the experience was really like with people who kind of got it and were coming at it from the same general backdrop of like, oh, hey, I live with loss too, and I get it, and there's no judgment. And so I also really wanted examples of resilience because I got really tired of people putting their hands on my shoulders. Well, one or the other shoulder. No, sometimes it was two shoulders if they were really intent, and they would say, it takes a year. And I'm like, okay. Like, and it, by the way, spoiler alert, it did not take a year. I was very much not okay on the second year. And I felt like, well, you know, and people would say, well, you're going to be okay, or you'll get through this or whatever. And I kind of wanted to be like, okay, how? So what does it look like after a year? How am I going to get through this? What are some examples? But no one had any because we're a culture that's steeped in platitudes because we like having the perfect things to say and perfect fixes for everything. And you just can't fix grief. And so all you can do is show people instead of telling them, just like you learn in journalism school, show, not tell. Show them examples of resilience. Show them examples of like, how are people doing rituals? How are people doing trigger days? How are people, you know, celebrating birthdays after a loss? How are people parenting after a loss? Don't tell them. Give them all these examples of human stories so that they can be exposed to them and maybe get ideas and be inspired by them. And just more than anything, just feel like they're not alone and they're not losing their minds in the mess of it all. And so that's what Modern Loss came out of, which was it was launched as an online publication at first, which publishes narrowly focused personal essays that are about any aspect of the long arc of loss. Like, we're not just talking about the first month or year. We're talking about anything because loss colors everything, like 24/7, forevermore. And not just in super sad ways, sometimes in really amazing ways that are, you know, about resilience and post-traumatic growth. And so it started as that. And then it just really grew into, you know, as you know, a lot of live storytelling events and a big global community. And we're on all the social platforms. And, you know, yeah, I mean, 8 years ago when I launched it with Gabby, I'd go to dinner parties and people would say, oh, what are you working on now? And I would say, well, I'm going to like start this publication that's about grief, but it's going to be really, it's going to be funny. Like, it's going to have like humor and it's going to be real and it's going to be relatable. And I got so many people saying, well, that's like, that's kind of morbid.
Don't do that.
Right. Like, oh, that's kind of weird. Like, I got so much side eye and I was like standing there being like, I literally used to work for Comedy Central. Like, I've known you for 10 years. I've known you for 20 years. Like, do you think I'm a morose person? This is like a real life affirming experience. Like, the whole point of this was to help people who were survivors of loss to feel like they could live really great lives, not just in spite of, but because of sometimes the hand that they've been dealt. And sometimes you really can't do that until you feel like you're in a community of people who totally get it on some level. And you just know that they're there to catch you. And you know that they're there to not make you feel like something's wrong with you because you're not okay after a year. They just get it. And I feel like knowing that you have a community of people, even if they're online people who you have never met at all and never will, like in real life, that's enough sometimes where you can hang your sanity on it and get through other times that might be really trying.
Yeah, I mean, I think that sense of community is so important because feeling uniquely sad, just as you said, if you like rest in that feeling forever and no one ever awakens you to the fact that however brutal this thing is, it's been done before. And many people have, you know, had it happen to them. And many of those people have continued to thrive and find, you know, meaning and purpose and happiness in their lives, that it can just totally calcify into this shame.
Yep.
That's really hard to get over. And I'll say that, you know, for me, the awareness of forums like Modern Loss really did change like the my perspective. The internet helped me, which I think is a sentence that almost is never true. Like tweeting about it and reading things on a, you know, on like what is, you know, like sort of like a communal souped up blog are two of the things that made me go, oh, you know what? Like you can continue to live and you can talk about this. Like it doesn't have to be a thing that only exists in your home when everyone else is asleep and you and your wife are like, God damn, I'm feeling so fucking sad right now. There's also someone two doors down who's feeling the same way.
Yeah.
It was a real awakening for me.
I think that just like having the knowledge that other people have dealt with unbelievable shit and are sharing that it's not like a one and done thing. It's not like, you know, by the way, I think the whole world is grieving right now. It's like the first time in 8 years that no one gives me side eye or thinks that what I do sounds morbid or morose. It's like people finally understand that this is like actually about living. This isn't about, I'm not like talking about corpses on Modern Loss. I'm talking about life. Like, how do you live well? Like, how do you share, you know, your stories in ways that are vulnerable and raw and real and connect with each other and build empathy and et cetera. And I just feel like how you posted on Twitter. I mean, I read when you posted that tweet in, was it 2019? And I was really moved by it. I mean, I immediately like saved it. And I think it's just takes people who are willing to take that step in sharing their stories and not pretending like it's like the experiences are easy or tied up with a nice little bow at the end or contain this mythical term called closure, because that's like not a thing, and that it's mixed emotions, you know, and that everything is not going to be okay anymore, actually. But a lot will, a lot can. And then it's like, was everything was okay anyway to begin with beforehand? No, it's just a new normal. And, you know, I think that living with loss is just like living in some ways with any other major adversity that you have to deal with, like illness or, you know, extreme, you know, like a job loss or any trauma. I mean, it's kind of like life is just a big shade of gray, and some of it is lighter and some of it is darker. And we try and talk through all of it in a way that's really open. And just knowing that people are out there willing to talk about it sometimes just calms you down.
Right.
You know, just knowing that you have, like, you don't, it's like, Michael, you don't have to talk about grief all, I mean, you do now because you have a podcast and you're amazing. Actually, you do have to talk about grief all the time, but most people don't. And when they realize that they have an ongoing invitation to, that's what calms them down. Just knowing that they can is enough.
I think it's like, you know, it's like a rising tide of things you want to talk about inside yourself and other people being like, oh, we could hold some of that.
Exactly.
You don't have to let that fill up until it explodes out of the top of your head. We have space for that right now too. And the way that the shorthand I've started using to describe people that you feel like you can talk to this stuff about is just being like, oh, well, like he's cool. Like that's who's cool. Who's cool is the people who have been through this awful shit. And it's obviously a club that you don't want to join, but the tragedy someone on the podcast previously talked about grief being a language. Mm-hmm. And I really think that's a very accurate description. It's like, I speak grief, you speak grief. Some people don't speak it, and it's not their fault. I mean, lucky them. Mm-mm. It's just they are not aware of it yet.
Right.
And so you can't really, you can talk to them about it, but they don't really understand. You can try as much as you want to make them understand, but they can't.
Right.
But then you can sit down with someone who speaks the same language you speak, and suddenly, like, the jokes are funnier, the sad things are sadder, everything is just more true because you're not conversing with them in subtitles or whatever.
Yeah. And you feel like, I feel like when you have moments like that, then you kind of sit back and you're like, okay, maybe I can do this, you know? And then an hour later, like, something can happen. You're like, oh my God, I want to die. Like, just to have moments like that, that remind you, like, okay, maybe I've got this. Like, maybe I can do this. Like, that's all we can hope for. Like, that's what life is. Life is this messy, uncertain disaster, you know? I mean, we're all aware of that by now. And I think that what grief does, and I'm talking about, you know, having somebody notable in your life die. And there's a lot of grief that is so valid. I'm just specifically talking about this right now. It kind of is like your superpower, you know, if you can live through something like that and figure out a way to stay connected to your person somehow through whatever rings true to you, through, you know, stay connected to yourself somehow, you know, which is like figuring out what your needs are, like how do you take care of your mind and your body, like not to sound super cheesy, but like grief really does take a hold of all of that. It really just like shakes you up and down. I got like a brain MRI because I thought I had like a brain tumor 6 months after my mom died. And no, it was grief. Like I had no idea. So if you can figure out a way to stay connected to your person and stay connected to yourself, and then especially stay connected to the world around you in ways that work for you, then you've really figured out how you can build a meaningful life and create meaning in the wake of just this terrible, really hard thing. And you deserve to. Like, you deserve to be resilient. You deserve to live well. You deserve to have joy. You know, there are going to be enough moments that are really shitty. So I feel like in the wake of loss, you just have to grab on to whatever joyful moments come along, you know? And, you know, I do feel like, I feel like when you can do those three things, that's a really powerful thing. But it's very hard to do them alone.
Yeah, I think that's so true.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I wanted to ask you about the grief that you've had is compounded. It's your mother dying and then your father dying in such, you know, chronological proximity to each other. How different were those griefs, or how different are those griefs when they happened and now?
So I think that, so modern loss is called modern loss for a reason. It's not called modern grief. And it's because I kind of view myself as, I don't view myself as like a grieving woman right now. I view myself very much as living with loss. It's like it's a presence in my life. It's there every day, you know? And sometimes it takes a hold of me and I'm super surprised. And sometimes I expect it to and it doesn't and I'm super surprised, you know? But it's there. Just like so many other things that we have to live with are there, you know, like illness or disabilities or, you know, anything. And so we called it modern loss because the idea is hopefully that, you know, in those early days of grief, you really do feel like grief is in charge. You know, you're not supposed to be in charge. I mean, there's this book out about how the brain works in grief that I just read. And it's talking about like how people feel like they're going crazy because even like several months down the line, they go to call this person. And while the phone is ringing or when it goes to like this number is disconnected, they're like, oh my God, I'm so dumb. They died. But this book talks about how our neurons, it's literally not our fault. Our neurons are quite literally programmed to assume that the person is there. Like it is a given. It's like that is what it knows to be true. And so the neuron simply cannot, it has to adapt to the new normal. It's quite literally not our doing. We can't, you know, we have no control over it. And so it kind of owns us. And so the idea is hopefully that as time goes on eventually, and it can take a long time. And by the way, the waves still ebb and flow. Like, I don't want to suggest that like, you know, 15 years after your brother dies, that you're not going to have really tough times. It's totally normal. It's a shifting thing. But the idea is that it's, you're kind of living with it. And the focus is on living and, you know, growing and building and not grieving. So that's why it's called Modern Loss. And I think that that's kind of reflective of my own experience, which is that, yeah, I miss my parents every single day. And I'm a grown-ass woman. Like, I still miss mom and dad. I do. I wish they were here. Although, I mean, I'm relatively relieved that they didn't have to do COVID. You know, that would have sucked. Or Trump. Or, you know, some other, okay, like some things, yeah, Putin. Okay, but, you know, but I miss them every day. And I would do anything I could to get them back, but I can't. And so I feel like I'm at this point where it's very much an acceptance stage, where it's kind of like, it is what it is. And so when you kind of can say it is what it is, then you really can move to the next stage, which is like, I'm not saying all these are linear stages. I'm saying for me, when I got to this an acceptance point where I'm like, oh, it is what it is. Like, I'm not going to ruminate over like, oh, if only she hadn't died or if my dad were around. They're not. So then what am I going to do here? This is life. This is no dress rehearsal. Like, every day is a day of my life. What can I do to like help myself? What can I do to like figure out how to like set boundaries with people who aren't making me feel good, or, you know, seek out the friends who I really would like to feel like I could, you know, use their support, or, you know, how can I like kind of level up to stand up for myself at work and tell my manager I need an extra week off to do something that might really help me? That's when, you know, that's where I'm at, you know, in my life, which, and it's not that it's not colored with loss. It's colored every single day. I don't think that I've made a major decision in my life in the last 15 years that wasn't rooted in the awareness of the fact that my mom and then my dad died. But it kind of is what it is.
So you and I have done a bunch of events together that are very joy-filled, but also are strongly tied to the idea of loss and grief, hosted by Modern Loss. And I wonder if there were times in the worst of it for you, after your mom died, after your dad died, that you look back on that were also like filled with joy or humor, that you remember at all, even in the bleakest times.
Oh my God, totally. Like, I mean, it's kind of morbid. I mean, talk about, you know, yes, there is like one morbid memory that I will share, but I guarantee you that at least one total listener will connect with this. So my mom died, as we are, well, we've established that fact, and her funeral was in their synagogue outside Philly. I'm from Lower Merion, Pennsylvania, land of Kobe. And her coffin was like, I don't know, backstage. I don't know like what you call it, right?
What the terms are, sure.
Yeah, I don't know I still don't know the funeral terms. But the coffin was backstage. And I, you know, again, keep in mind, like, I was in shock. I was in shock for a calendar year, Michael. Like, I couldn't listen to music for 1 year after she died. And I played violin for 17 years when I was younger. Like, music is like, I always have music on, and it felt like grating to I couldn't handle it. It was too much sensory overload. So I was in so much shock. at her funeral, and I had written like a letter for her. And I remember, I remember kind of in a stupor picking out something that I felt like she should wear for eternity. And I wanted to see her, and I hadn't seen her since the accident. And they had cautioned me that I probably shouldn't. And I just insisted, like backstage, I was like, someone needs to witness her. And I, again, didn't have siblings there. And my dad wasn't going to do it. He was in the car with my mom when she died. So, you know, he was pretty traumatized already. And I was like, someone needs to see her. And so I made them open the coffin, and they had, you know, done the very best that they could with her. And, you know, her face luckily was intact. But it definitely didn't look like her, because by like when you die, you really don't look like yourself. But I remember focusing on her lipstick, and I had specifically given them like the Clinique, like number 72 that she always bought at Lord & Taylor to put on her lips. And they had used this like really garish coral shade that just, it was like the fugliest color I'd ever seen. And it already like didn't look like my mom. And this was just like, she looked so trashy. And I was so pissed. And I literally took, like, I was like searching around. And then I started like yelling at the funeral attendant. I was like, she looks like I remember, I'm like, she looks like fucking Timothy Baker. Like, this is abominable. Like, she can't. Like, she cannot go to like eternity looking like this. And I fixated on that. And then like, I remember just, it was like, I was possessed. I like scrubbed off her lips, and then I put my own lipstick on her. And then I was like, okay, you can close it now. Like, and then I like calmed down and became like a human person again. And they stopped, like, you know, they took the hand off the phone that was probably calling security. And yeah. And then I remember like later that night, I was still in shock, and I was definitely not okay. But I had a pretty good laugh thinking about how my mom would have really appreciated the fact that I would not let her go to the grave wearing that whatever, like Wet n Wild coral, whatever they had in like the back of the funeral home.
Wet n Wild.
Yeah. I mean, I always got that at Woolworths. Not to ding Wet n Wild. They had some fun colors. But yeah. So like, you know, it's funny. People say, when is it okay to laugh after a loss? Like, when is it okay to laugh in grief? And I always say, like, whenever you want to, like whenever you naturally laugh, like who cares? Who's judging you? And whoever's judging you, by the way, don't pay attention to them. There, I guarantee you, there will be enough crappy moments. Like, I promise you, you're going to feel really bad. Don't worry.
Yeah, you will get that.
Yeah, you will get that. Like, you're going to feel terrible. But if that moment of levity comes, if that moment of unexpected joy where you catch yourself laughing at something, like either knowingly or in a memory or just something that's super, super morbid and like dark humory, like the coffin lipstick gate, go with it. Why not? You have to like hold on to it, you know? And I really encourage, that's like a real tenet of modern loss. Like, I would say the tenet number one is that storytelling is a change agent. And sorry, it sounds cheesy, but I really believe it. I really do. And I know you believe it too, Michael.
Yeah.
It's why you're doing what you do. And the number two is that you have every right to live the best life possible in the wake of this. And not just like, oh, your person would have wanted it for you, because there are plenty of people who lose people who they really didn't have a good relationship with. So I don't want to say, oh, their person would have wanted it. I know my parents would have wanted it for me, but more, I want it for me. I'm here. I'm here. And so... and I chose to be here. And there were some moments where I wouldn't have minded getting hit by a Mack truck walking down Broadway in my darkest moments. But I'm here. So like, I want to make it worthwhile. I owe it to myself, and I owe it to anybody else who's in my life to make it worthwhile. And that's what I'm trying to do. Like, that's what I'm trying to do with my work and the messages we put out there and the community. And what more can you do?
Rebecca, you also have a book coming out. Can you tell us about that?
Why, yes, I can. So it's called The Modern Loss Handbook, an interactive guide to moving through grief and building your resilience. And it comes out on May 17th with Running Press. And I I honestly, I mean, there's no other point than to be totally honest. It's literally the book that I wish that someone would have handed to me after my mom died and then after my dad died and then 5 years after they died. I wrote it in the deepest, darkest depths of last winter's COVID isolation, in a time of such extreme loss around the world when I was so isolated, you know, in the Berkshires in Western Massachusetts with my family, and I hadn't really seen other people for so long. And I realized that I just had so much to say about those things that we talked about earlier, about like, how do you stay connected to your person? How do you stay connected to yourself? How do you stay connected to the world around you? Because I'd been so overwhelmed by the needs of the modern loss community, which had really like ballooned, the numbers had ballooned over the course of COVID, not just to, because of people who have lost people to COVID, but because so much resurfaced grief coming up and so many things that people really needed to talk about. And so I was going to write this book before the pandemic, but then it stalled a bit. And then this really just, I just had stuff to say, and I said it, and I'm really proud of it. So it's a book that you can write in. It's like equal parts taskmaster and friend and martini hander and challenger, you know, and tough love giver, and creative ideas suggester. So it's like a fully written book. It's not a workbook, but it is a handbook. So like there are places where you can write it and then scribble in it and like, you know, rip pages out, and you could throw it against the wall for 4 months. Who cares? But it really is meant to be like a thing that suggests a lot of things that really do need to be considered in the wake of loss to help you live well. So I'm excited.
And I should also say, as a co-plug of this book, I have read the book. It is fantastic. And it's also like, you know, so much literature about grief is very like, feels like it's in calligraphy and it's whispery tones and it's like pure moods, music in the background. And this feels much more real and like kind of fun-ish and not like 5 million tons of bullshit.
Yeah.
So I highly recommend it to anyone. If you feel like you could use it, or you think someone that you know could use it, I hope that you will give it a chance, because it's tremendous.
I think that there are only so many casseroles that someone can get. Let's put it that way.
And the casseroles are great. I love a casserole.
Who doesn't? Don't get me wrong. But how many can you eat at once? And especially if you live in New York, how many can you store at once? And
that's exactly right.
You know, I personally don't think there's anything wrong with giving somebody something that can help themselves. And the truth of the matter is that if only the world were there to catch us with like satin gloves on a nice pillow and like rub a little kitten against your cheek after you go through a loss. But the world sucks a lot, you know, it's a really hard world. And the fact of the matter is it's kind of on us to figure out how to muddle through this. And because we do such a bad job of talking about this stuff in our culture, it is on us to figure out, how do we tell people what we need? What do we need, and how do we get it? And then when we do that, then we help the next person who's going to go through it, and we help them maybe support somebody else. And so, yeah, in some Pollyanna-ish way, yeah, the goal is to really change a culture. And I think that your work and my work and the work of so many amazing, you know, organizations and people out there right now are really starting to change it. We have to.
Rebecca, do you think of your parents as someplace now? What are your beliefs or feelings on that?
I don't believe in heaven or hell, except for when it's convenient to believe in hell for certain people. So I'm like, I'm a fair weather hell acknowledger. I really wish that I did. And I don't actually think that I've ever answered a question like this on an interview, to be honest.
Secret's out now.
Yeah. I am Jewish. I am a proud Jew, you know, 20 years Upper West Sider, you know, always have bagels on Sundays. I am super, you know, Jewy, but I'm not religious. And I don't automatically believe like in, I wish that I believed, let's put it this way, that my mom was here and looking down on me and so proud of me. And I wish that I believed that, because it would really make it so much nicer, so much easier for me. But I just can't get there. I don't believe that things happen for a reason. If I did believe that, then let me tell you, the fact of my parents' death would be even harder to stomach, because I don't know what the reason would have been. It's senseless to me. I believe in happenstance and bad luck and numbers and, you know, just things happening in the universe. And it's not why me, it's kind of like, why not me, you know? And so when it comes to where I think they are, I don't have a really good answer for you, because it doesn't really point to anything specific. But let's put it this way. I definitely don't think my mom is like sitting in the chair next to me right now. But at the same time, I cannot bring myself to believe that someone's energy vanishes. They had so much energy. They had so much life force. And I don't understand what happens to it, but I know it's somewhere. I feel it. I don't feel it like they're invisible and they're intact, you know, next to me, but I feel like I feel it. I feel it sometimes when I'm with my kids, or when I'm driving down the street and, you know, a Lou Reed song comes on, like at just the right time, and, you know, or some things happen that I can't explain, or, you know, I have a dream, which I don't have a lot. I wish I had a lot more. Or if I have a dream that kind of sometimes feels really good, I'll wake up and I'll just choose to hold on to it. But I do feel like energy is such an incredible thing, and I don't understand how it can vanish. And for me, that's enough. That's enough to hold on to.
That's beautiful, Rebecca. I think that's our episode. This was A Good Cry with Rebecca Sofer, and I hope it helps. Hey, buds, it's Michael Cruz Kane again. Remember me? Thanks for listening to that episode with the fantastic Rebecca Sofer. Just reminding you to subscribe, rate, review, share, memorize every word of this podcast and shout it aloud from the nearest mountaintop. Appreciate you. Thanks for listening. See you next episode.
A Good Cry is produced by Radio Point and HeadGum, with executive producers Alex Bach, Sabrina Fonfetter, Richard Corson, Daniel Powell, and Houston Snyder. Recorded, edited, and mixed by Bree Mattan.
That was a HeadGum podcast.